What? What? What?
I know how we can run everybody out of Rock Ridge.
How?
We'll kill the firstborn male child in every household.
Too Jewish.
Shalom, and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Dr. Harry Osterer, author of the new book, Legacy, A Genetic History of the Jewish People. We'll also have visits from our Too Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbert. Please email your comments to us at TooJewishRadio@Yahoo.com or visit us on the web at TooJewishRadio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom and Chag Sameach, a happy completion of the holiday season. The last of the long run of Jewish fall festivals begins tonight with Simchat Torah and Shmini Atzeret in slightly different combinations for Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox Jews, and even between the Jews living in Israel and the rest of us living outside the Holy Land. It's a little bit complicated, and I'll explain more in a minute. But first, a little bit about the holiday we are finishing up, Sukkot. Sukkot, also called the Feast of Tabernacles, is a lovely festival filled with outdoor celebration and gratitude. Traditionally, we invite guests to join us in our sukkah, our outdoor booth, for meals and parties over the course of the week. This hospitality is an ancient practice, part of our biblical heritage going back to Abraham. But on Sukkot, we are supposed to live it most fully. By custom, we also invite special spiritual guests to join us during the holiday, a series of great biblical figures who become our ushpizin, the Aramaic word for guests. On the first night of Sukkot, we invited Abraham and Sarah to join us, the patriarch and matriarch. The second night, it was Isaac and Rebekah. The third night, Jacob and Rachel and Leah. Then Joseph, Moses, Aaron, King David, and King Solomon. The idea is that these spiritual visitors bring additional honor to our humble sukkah and carry with them the good wishes of the whole of Jewish tradition. It's the quality of the guests who turn even the humblest hut into a palace of hospitality. In a way, this warm Sukkot tradition is a great way to remind ourselves to keep our lives open to new possibility while welcoming those we care about into our lives with open arms and open doors. I think about our Too Jewish radio show exactly the same way. It's an invitation. After all, we use some of the same language with me as your host, and I hope that you feel invited into the sukkah of our hospitality as surely as if you were sitting at the table in my sukkah this morning, noshing a few Sukkot delicacies and enjoying the season of Thanksgiving and joy. It's a good time of year to be Jewish. Not that every time of year isn't, but following the rigors of repentance during the High Holy Days, this is a very nice period to celebrate identity and friendship and all the good things in life. The joyous festival of Simchat Torah is just hours away, coming up tonight. We'll sing and dance with the Torah and celebrate our millennia-old love affair with the book that forms the heart of our great tradition. The process of reading Torah works like this. We divide it up into bite-sized reading pieces, which we chant weekly. And over the course of the year, we wend our way from the creation of the world at the start of Genesis all the way to the death of Moses at the end of Deuteronomy, at which point we do the Jewish thing and start that same reading cycle all over again. Why, you might ask, do we just go right back and read the same book all over again? Isn't there, as Ecclesiastes asks, anything new under the sun? Well, yes and no. Of course, the Torah doesn't change. In fact, it hasn't changed in an awfully long time. The Dead Sea Scrolls prove it goes back 2,000 years, and most scholars put the composition of the final text of Torah between 2,500 years and 3,200 years ago. That's an old book by human standards, and it's meticulously preserved precisely so the text does not change. So if the book's the same, why keep reading it again and again? The simple answer is that although the Torah doesn't change, we do. Each year, we change a bit, sometimes a lot. And so we need to constantly set our own intellect, experience, and emotional knowledge in a sacred context. In this case, a book filled with wisdom, great writing, theological belief, and fabulous mythical storytelling that reaches the apex of human creativity. Not a bad habit to get into, reading, chanting, and studying Torah. To celebrate the coming holiday of Simchat Torah, last of the fall festival cycle, here's a Yemenite Jewish song about the greatness of Torah, Mi Pi El, from the mouth of God. There is none like our God, none blessed like our people, nothing great as the Torah. So, while Simchat Torah is a delightful way to conclude this orgy of non-stop festival experiences that dates back all the way to early September in the Slichot service preceding Rosh Hashanah, there's a complication. We're Jews, of course. Has to be complicated. The last day of Sukkot is a kind of separate festival called Shmini Atzeret, the eighth day of assembly. This is a fairly serious day during the time of joy. We include both the elaborate prayer for rain and the memorial service for Yisker. In Orthodox and conservative congregations outside of Israel, we have Shmini Atzeret one day, and then Simchat Torah the next day. But in Reform congregations and in Israel, we usually combine the two into one not very well-fitting holiday called Atzeret Simchat Torah. There are good and complicated historic and religious reasons to do this, but the most important fact to remember about all this is to celebrate both holidays on either one day or two. And after all these holidays, serious, somber, grateful, and joyous, we are pleased to welcome a guest this morning to Two Jewish who is brilliant, fascinating, and not holiday-oriented. Are Jews a race or a religion, or both, or are we something else? Jewish genetics is a cutting-edge field, and we'll find out just what's happening today that tells us a great deal about our own identity when we return on Two Jewish.
Hi, Joe Spina, Mama's Pizza. This spring, Mama's Pizza was invited to be a food vendor at the Sunday night Tucson Pops concerts at Reed Park. Well, this fall, we had the honor of being invited back. I guess that even in the middle of a park, people can't resist fresh hot pizza when it's made with the best ingredients available and served at a value price. Go figure. But I gotta tell you, even after all these years, when I bite into a fresh hot slice of Mama's Pizza, I always start to hear beautiful music in my head. You see, it's not just me. I bet you hear it too. The truth is, delicious pizza, heroes, calzones, pasta, and desserts will always be music to your ears when you visit one of our four locations. Check them out at mamasfamous.com. Now you know the drill. Repeat after me. Mama's Pizza.
Parents in Tucson have many choices on where to send their children to school. Consider the best. Consider Tucson Hebrew Academy. Now is the time to secure your spot for the upcoming school year. With a beautiful Foothills K-8 campus and award-winning academics, you owe it to your children to visit THA, Tucson Hebrew Academy, and see what they have to offer. Your child belongs at THA. THA delivers. Low student-teacher ratio supports successful, rigorous academics, and they don't stop there. With an emphasis on the arts, science, and music, THA students learn the Hebrew language and are taught Jewish values along with a rigorous academic curriculum. Your child deserves the best. Call 529-3888 to schedule your tour of THA. Financial aid is available. Don't wait. Space is limited. That's 529-3888 or visit www.thaaz.org. We are delighted to welcome to Two Jewish our guest this morning, Dr. Harry Ostrer. He's a professor of pathology and genetics at Albert Einstein College of Medicine and the director of genetic and genomic testing at Montefiore Medical Center. And his new book is called Legacy, A Genetic History of the Jewish People, which is a fascinating subject and one we've played with a little bit before on Two Jewish. Welcome, Chag Sameach.
Chag Sameach.
So, briefly, genetic history of the Jewish people. Tell us what it's like to try to sort of map the Jewish genetic makeup of the world.
To map the Jewish genetic makeup of the world required getting Jews to participate in genetic studies. And it turned out that that was a pretty easy thing to do, although notably we did get turned down in a few communities that weren't comfortable with delving into their genetic makeup. But we did recruit participants from 16 different Jewish communities, and so that really covered a very broad range of the Jewish diaspora. We now have quite wonderful tools in human genetics for doing population research, so that using DNA chips, which some of the listeners may be familiar with, it's really possible to look at points over the entire genome and then compare these both within and across Jewish populations, as well as comparing Jews with non-Jews.
You know, one of the interesting things you do in the book is you sort of build up the, you know, funny you don't look Jewish. Some of the ways in which people have tried to study whether Jews are a race or not. So I'll cut right to it. Is there such a thing as a Jewish race?
I don't think that there's such a thing as a Jewish race. The term race has become rather vague anyway, and it's become conflated with racism. So it's one that Jews and, you know, geneticists tend to shy away from. But there certainly is a very high degree of relatedness among Jews, both within specific diaspora groups as well as across diaspora groups. So I suppose if I had to choose a Yiddish or a Hebrew term, it would be mishpocha.
So we're part of the great Jewish family rather than any particular racial combination.
That is certainly true, and people tend to think about humanity as being divided among various continental groups, and yet Jews have lived in many different continents. So Jews in Europe are somewhat related to Europeans. Jews in the Middle East are related to Middle Easterners. Jews in North Africa are related to North Africans. And yet, for all of these groups, there is a high degree of relatedness among them.
We will speak much more with Harry Ostrer about his book, Legacy, A Genetic History of the Jewish People. Very interesting and fascinating topic when we come back on To Jewish. Among my most pleasant and least time-consuming duties, I have the honor of serving as president of the Kohan Memorial Foundation, which celebrates the memories of Rabbi Samuel S. and A. Irma Kohan, my grandparents. Once a year, the foundation gives a substantial cash award to an individual for outstanding service to Klal Yisrael, the total Jewish people. This service can involve any one of four different fields: unity, education and information, creative arts, or rescue. If you know anyone who might qualify for the 2012 Kohan Award, just visit our website, kohanaward.com, that's KOHON award.com, and you can find the nomination form there. And while you're there, you can also learn just who my own grandparents were and who participates in honoring their memory today. That's KOHONAWARD.com, KohanAward.com. It's a good visit and a great place to learn about a terrific award and all the recipients.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, twojewishradio.com, or download us from there at the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcasts. As a baseball fan, and especially a Los Angeles Dodgers fan, there were several painful moments last week. First, the Giants again knocked the Dodgers out of the playoffs, this time on October 2nd by defeating them in the next-to-last game of the season. Then it was the 50th anniversary of the epic 1962 comeback when the Giants beat the Dodgers and Sandy Koufax in a three-game playoff to go to the World Series, scoring four runs in the ninth inning of the final game at then-brand-new Dodger Stadium to finish it off. The Dodgers had been four games ahead with seven to play and collapsed, although they did win 102 games that year. And finally, last week we observed, 11 years earlier than that 62 painful memory, but on the same exact day, October 4th, the 61st anniversary of the most melancholy moment in Dodgers history, Giant Bobby Thompson's shot heard round the world off of Dodgers pitcher Ralph Branca way back in 1951. Also for the right to go to the World Series. It's one of the most famous games in Major League history. That year, the Dodgers blew a 13.5-game lead on August 11th. There are many famous photos of the pitcher who threw that fateful ball walking off the mound at the old Polo Grounds in New York disconsolately, his Brooklyn uniform number 13 showing clearly. Now, why relive all this pain as a Dodgers fan? Is it just because we Jews love suffering? No. Actually, there's a very Jewish backstory to the 1951 game that is well worth telling in this baseball-oriented fall time of year. In 1951, Ralph Branca was a fine pitcher for the Dodgers, a former 20-game winner who finished in the top 10 in ERA that year. A big man with a good fastball, he was a popular player and well-liked by his teammates. He also had an incredible memory, at one point winning 17 consecutive episodes of the TV show Concentration in 1961. Branca's moment of infamy did not ruin his life. Ralph Branca eventually became friends with Bobby Thompson, doing many joint interviews and TV shows. And 60 years later, Jewish New York Times reporter Joshua Prager, who wrote a book about Branca and Thompson, revealed that Ralph Branca, raised a Catholic at Mount Vernon, New York, was actually the son of a Jewish woman named Caddy Berger, who had immigrated from what was then Hungary. Apparently, Branca's mother hid her Jewish origin from Branca and his 15 brothers and sisters throughout her life. Most of Branca's mother's family was murdered by the Nazis, a fact she also hid from them. As it turns out, October 4th, 1951, the day of the Thompson home run, was also Tzom Gedalia, a minor Jewish fast day of mourning. Somehow fitting when you find out that Branca was at least halachically Jewish. When told of this startling turn of history, Branca was quite accepting last year. First he said, "Oh boy, my mother never mentioned this to me." A good-natured man, after musing about the fact that he hadn't practiced his mother's religion, I mean, he couldn't have known, "Maybe that's why God's mad at me, that I didn't practice my mother's religion. He made me throw that home run pitch. Remember, Jesus was a Jew." But actually, Branca, who was very positive on Jews and Judaism, remains a devout Catholic. Branca did remember that as a boy, he had been a Shabbos goy for a neighbor, lighting the stove for a Jewish family, the Lichtenfelds, every Friday night. As he said, he wouldn't have done it if he thought he was violating God's rules. In any case, it's probably just as well that Branca's Judaism wasn't known back in 1951. We got blamed for enough things in those days. In his final spring training game, Ralph Branca was relieved by another Dodger pitcher whose Judaism was not so hidden from him, Sandy Koufax. By the way, Branca's daughter Mary married a future Dodgers player, the current manager of the Boston Red Sox, Bobby Valentine. They seem kind of cursed this year, too. Here is our weekly 2012 presidential election campaign Jewish moment. If money is the lifeblood of contemporary American political campaigns, then Jews on both sides are pouring plasma into this election. Last week, billionaire George Soros pledged $1 million to a super PAC that supports President Obama. That donation was announced at a luncheon held by the Democracy Alliance, a group of liberal donors. Soros is also set to donate $500,000 to two super PACs backing congressional Democrats. With the donation, Soros now has given $4.3 million during this election cycle to PACs supporting Democrats. He is the largest donor on the left. Soros donated $24 million, however, to outside groups supporting Democrats ahead of the 2004 election, so this marks a major drop-off in his funding of American elections. By contrast, casino mogul Sheldon Adelson has pledged to spend up to $100 million to defeat Obama and congressional Democrats in the upcoming elections, roughly 25 times as much as Soros is donating. Adelson previously funded almost all of Newt Gingrich's failed run for the Republican presidential nomination. Super PACs can raise unlimited sums from corporations, unions, and other groups, as well as individuals, and indirectly support a political candidate. They cannot, by law, coordinate with a candidate's official campaign. Wink, wink, nudge, nudge. And that's our campaign 2012 Jewish election moment. We welcome our maven on Israel, Guy Gilbert, head of the Weintraub Israel Center here in Tucson. Boker Tov, Guy, Chag Sameach.
Boker Tov, Chag Sameach.
The Rachel Corrie case, which has been such a big publicity, really problem for Israel, worked its way through the courts in Israel. At the end of the summer, it was finally dismissed by a court, I think, in your native Haifa. Tell us a little bit about the case and what it means.
Rachel Corrie's case was a case of a young American girl, 19 years of age, that went into the Gaza Strip, into the Rafah area, and unfortunately was killed in an accident with a military bulldozer. For many, many years, her case was used by the voices that tried to bash Israel to try and claim that Israel deliberately killed her and that the bulldozer driver deliberately ran over her. And Rachel Corrie was presented with a film and with a theater show as some kind of a peace activist, peaceful person that came there and was trying to help bring peace to the world. After 9 long years of very, very significant court discussions, in which the court in Haifa have looked into all the details, all the evidence, the court concluded that nothing of those accusations was correct or even close to the truth. Even the witness, the expert that was brought by Corrie's parents, testified in court that the bulldozer driver could not have seen her, that Corrie received numerous numbers of warnings not to go into the area where she gone. And also it was proven in court that despite the claims as if Corrie was protecting a Palestinian house, that wasn't the case. Corrie was protecting an area where a Palestinian terrorist organization have booby trapped, and the bulldozer came there in order to remove those booby traps from the road. Okay, so all the proofs shows that the story that we heard about Rachel Corrie was a fake, was a false story. Still, I must say, Corrie was a victim. Corrie was a victim, but she wasn't a victim of the IDF or of Israel. She was a victim of the same people that are now using her story to bash Israel, the same people that are now trying to get young American adults to think that if they go into a war zone they don't understand, they're serving peace. And they are using those people, organizations like the ISM, that used Corrie in this case and brought her to risk her life and to pay with her life, are organizations that are cynically using young adults, their passion, their wish to correct the world, and they are brainwashing them or getting them, misguiding them to do acts that are not supportive of peace, risking their own lives and sometimes paying with their own life, because that serves their, I want to say, for lack of a better phrase, their evil intention of creating bad media against Israel, of creating those spins against Israel, and they don't care about the life of those young Americans or Europeans. And I think that's something that the world should point out at. Those people that use those young adults to bash Israel and take them into war zones that they don't understand, risk them and put them in such danger, they should be thrown in jail.
Thank you, Guy. It's a painful but important message. We will talk next week.
Thank you.
When we come back, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and get the old Jewish joke of the week.
Everything you always wanted to know about Judaism, but were afraid to ask. A Taste of Judaism, the largest and most successful outreach program in the country, celebrates its 13th anniversary year with a brand new family class and in a new location. Over 5,000 people have completed the course offered by Temple Emmanuel, Arizona's first congregation. It's your turn now. Taste of Judaism is free and open to all, Jewish or not. And we feed you, too. Rabbi Sam Kohan and Rabbi Jason Holtz lead an open, interactive exploration of the history and practice of Judaism in 3 2-hour sessions on spirituality, values, and community. Classes are offered all over the Tucson area, and enrollment is easy. Call 520-327-4501 to sign up. Taste of Judaism is a tremendously successful education and outreach program and an exciting learning opportunity for anyone who is simply curious about Judaism or who wants to deepen their knowledge and gain an understanding of Jewish culture, history, rituals, community, and practice. The classes include delicious tastes of traditional Jewish foods. The sessions are free and open to all, regardless of religious background. But you do need to pre-enroll by calling 520-327-4501. This year, Taste of Judaism is offering both daytime and evening classes in Central, Northwest, and East Tucson, and the very popular Taste of Judaism family class held at the Tucson Hebrew Academy. Adults enjoy a grown-up taste class with rabbis, while kids have their own Taste of Judaism children's program with Jewish stories, crafts, and activities with excellent THA teachers. It's a great learning opportunity for the whole family. There is no fee or obligation, but space is limited and pre-registration is required. Call Mila Anderson at 520-327-4501 for more information and register today.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reformed, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom, and Chag Sameach.
Good morning, Rabbi. And I think we're near the end of all these chagim.
Finally, so. The marathon is almost in the last mile. Right. It's Simchat Torah. If you're Reform, it's tonight. If you're Conservative or Orthodox, it's tomorrow night. If you're in Israel, then it's in a few hours from now. Take your pick. Simchat Torah, however, was in some ways the most important holiday for Jews in the Soviet Union when it existed. That was the one holiday when they were allowed to get together, even if there was lots of KGB people there in places like Moscow and Leningrad and all around the Soviet Union. Important to remember that.
Right.
Today, and really ever since the beginnings of the fall of the Soviet Union, creating Jewish life for those Jews who were atheistic for so long and educated as such and pushed in that direction, but knew they were Jews nonetheless, has been a very complicated task. Many of them went to Israel, but many did not. The one organization that had feet on the ground almost from the beginning, when it was not easy to do so, was Chabad. Can you talk about their presence, particularly in Eastern Europe?
Right. I think I'd like to talk about both their recent history on the ground in these countries and also their historic identity and where they come from and how they differ from other Jews or how they're the same, which is maybe more your area of expertise than mine. But, you know, in answer to your specific question, yes, when the Soviet Union fell, and even before, because of the Jackson-Vanik Amendment and other things, when the Soviets started letting Jews leave as a way of dealing with them, Jews were required, in some senses, to reimburse the state for their education and for their upbringing and their free medical care and whatever as they left for either Israel or places in Central Europe like Berlin, where the vast majority of today's Jewish community consists of Jews whose roots are in the former Soviet Union, or the United States, for that matter.
Of course.
You know, Jews went to lots of places, but those were mostly Jews who identified as Jews. And then there was this much bigger category of Jews who vaguely knew they were Jewish because they were discriminated against, in many cases, for having Jewish names, but they had no Jewish education or identity or practice. And almost as soon as it was possible, and certainly almost immediately after the breakup of the former Soviet Union into 15 new countries, Chabad was in there on the ground with rabbis and teachers and families, often in countries that were still in turmoil, where physical existence was very difficult. Just basic things like lodging and electricity and food, and not to mention security or a legal framework or the ability to transfer money in and out. I mean, it was tough going. And they were there encouraging the development of Jewish communal institutions, but with a particular sort of brand of Judaism that is, in some sense, closely related to the holiday we celebrate these days of Simchat Torah. It's about joy, and it's about Torah. And I think maybe you can give a more objective little synopsis of the history of Chabad than I can, but I think it's important to recognize the huge and unique role that Chabad has played in the former Soviet Union, in particular in Central and Eastern Europe more generally, in bridging the Soviet times with the post-Soviet era that we're living in today.
That sounds like a great subject for next week, Tom. Chag Sameach, a happy holiday of Simchat Torah, and Shemini Atzeret.
Same to you, thanks.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week, Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Rachel and her husband Max are in their local kosher restaurant. As usual, within minutes of taking her seat, Rachel starts to bother the waiter. "Waiter," she says, "please to turn up the air conditioning. You know, I can't stand the hot atmosphere." 5 minutes later, Rachel calls over the waiter again. "Waiter," she says, "now it's freezing in here. Please to turn down the air conditioning. It's too cold." 5 minutes after that, she wants it turned up again. She's getting too hot. "Waiter, now it's boiling like chicken soup. Please turn down the air conditioning." Finally, her food arrives at the table and she says, "again, it's too cold. Waiter, please to turn up the air conditioning." A guy sitting at a nearby table can't help but notice. He sees the shocking patience of the waiter and calls him over. "Waiter," he says, "you are amazing. Why don't you just throw her out of the restaurant?" "Oh, we really don't mind," says the waiter, "because not only do we believe the customer is always right, but also this restaurant doesn't have air conditioning." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, a special feature of Too Jewish just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week we celebrate Simchat Torah, tonight at 6:30 p.m., the wonderful festival when we complete the reading of Torah and start all over again at the very beginning. A very good place to start. Breishit, the very first Torah portion of the year, presents a unique challenge for every commentator. There is so much to say. Where to begin? Which is, of course, precisely the point, for Genesis is the beginning not only of Torah, but of Judaism and all Western religion, including Christianity and Islam. It starts with the great theological creation in Breishit and the immortal, eternal words, Breishit bara Elohim, in the beginning, God created. These are instantly recognizable words, more famous than nearly all phrases in religious literature. But this celebrated commencement is actually a problem. You see, in Hebrew, the word breishit actually means at the beginning of, in the grammatical form called smichut, attached. It must therefore be followed by a noun. Yet here, at the very start of the beginning of the holiest and most ancient text in our tradition, it's followed by a verb, bara, created. That is, the first two words of the Torah don't agree, you know, like Jews in general. There's a grammatical error in the absolute first place it could occur in the whole Bible, which is, of course, not only our Bible, but the first text of Christianity, Islam, and all of Western civilization. What might this mistaken phrase mean? Commentators throughout history have engaged the question. Perhaps it means at the beginning of time, God created. Perhaps it means at the beginning of God's creation of the universe, God created. Perhaps it means at the beginning of the world, God created. Come up with your own fix, if you'd like. Well, why don't we just correct it? All traditional associations aside, we have had this text for at least 2,000 years and so on, there's a simple explanation that opens up the whole process of studying Torah and being an active Jew in a wonderful way. You see, if the very first words of Genesis make us think and interact with the text, every passage of Torah must therefore be open to interpretation. That means we instantly become partners with God in the creation of Torah, in this generation, in every generation. Each of us must create her or his own understanding of Torah, must make it meaningful to him or her. Every one of us has to insert ourselves into this incredible book and find our own way. In the spaces between the words, each of us must create our own midrash, our own interpretation of Judaism that will bring meaning and holiness to our lives. It's a remarkable invitation. Breshit bara Elohim, at the beginning of Torah, God created the process of Midrash, and so invited us as partners to think, learn, teach, and embrace our own Judaism. When we come back on To Jewish, our guest, Dr. Harry Ostreher, will tell you if Judaism is in your genes or in your environment. The answer will surprise you. Find out when we come back on To Jewish.
Safety. It's a word we take for granted at home and at the workplace, but sometimes safety isn't a sure thing. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is an environmental remediation company that's been promoting safe living in Arizona since 1989. Environmental Strategies specializes in asbestos and lead abatement, mold remediation, and industrial cleaning. In addition, they have a building and remodeling division that makes it convenient for clients to get all their services from one contractor. Environmental Strategies jobs range from seam tape removal in a single-family home to insulation removal in a Challenger Learjet aircraft, and everything in between. So, if you're in need of asbestos or lead removal, mold remediation, industrial cleaning, or top-notch general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies today at 884-1114. Estimates and bids are free and confidential. Ken Goodman is the president, and he'd love to talk with you about your project. Environmental Strategies, serving all of Arizona since 1989. Call 884-1114. We continue with our Two Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
In a surprise announcement, Shai Agassi, the Israeli-American founder of Better Place, which is bringing electric car charging stations to Israel, was ousted as the company's CEO. Agassi will remain a member of the Better Place board. He is being replaced by Evan Thornley, currently head of the company's Australian unit. Better Place, based in Palo Alto, California, has raised more than $750 million in investments since it was founded in 2007. In that same time, however, the company has lost nearly $500 million. Better Place provides charge spots and battery switching stations for the electric car Renault Fluence ZE, which recently went on sale in Israel. The idea is that Israel will eventually become a fully electric car country. It's almost 5 years to the day since Shai launched Better Place, and a natural point in the company's evolution to realign for its second chapter and for the challenges and opportunities ahead, said Idan Ofer unhelpfully, the Israeli chairman of Better Place. 5 years ago, I followed my passion to make the world a better place and founded a company to materialize that vision, said Agassi. Very few people are blessed to see such a grand vision become a proven reality within a relatively short time frame. We hope that that vision is realized in spite of Agassi's departure. The museum where the priceless centuries-old Sarajevo Haggadah is kept closed last week due to lack of funds. Jacob Finchi, the longtime leader of the Jewish community of Sarajevo, said that the 125-year-old National Museum closed October 4th due to lack of money, financing, and support from the state. He called the decision tragic, but said he did not fear for the Sarajevo Haggadah, which will be kept in a safe place. The Haggadah, handwritten in Spain in the 14th century, brought to Sarajevo after the expulsion of the Jews of Spain in 1492, has been owned by the museum in Sarajevo since 1894. During the Bosnian War of the 1990s, the lavishly illustrated 109-page priceless book became a symbol of the shattered dream of multi-ethnic harmony in Bosnia. After the war ended in 1995, the UN mission, along with the Bosnian Jewish community, the Joint Distribution Committee, and the Yad Hanadiv and Wolf Wolfensohn Foundations facilititated a $150,000 project to restore the Haggadah and prepare a secure new climate-controlled room to display it. There was a gala ceremony in December of 2002, but in recent years the actual Haggadah has only been displayed 4 days a year. All the rest of the time a facsimile was shown. The Bosnian central government no longer provides state funding for culture, and several other major cultural institutions have also been forced to close. And finally, in a feel-good baseball story, Adam Greenberg, a ball player who was hit in the head by a pitch and injured during his first major league at-bat for the Chicago Cubs way back in 2005, finally got another chance at the bigs. This has to be the most upbeat strikeout in major league history. Pinch hitting for the Marlins, Greenberg struck out after facing three knuckleballs in the bottom of the sixth, thrown by New York Mets star pitcher R.A. Dickey. Greenberg swung at the second and third pitches thrown by Dickey, who said beforehand, "I'm going to treat him like a big leaguer. That's why he's here." Greenberg's story resurfaced in headlines in September when he was tapped to replace the injured Gabe Kapler for Team Israel in the World Baseball Classic qualifiers in Florida. In his only at-bat of the qualifiers, Greenberg walked on a full count by a South African pitcher and scored on a single by former big league star Sean Green. The Israeli team, made up of a number of American players and including several former big leaguers, failed to advance to the finals. Around that time in September, an online campaign called One At Bat had fans rallying for Adam Greenberg to be given one more shot at the majors. He had not played for a big league organization since 2008. Greenberg was offered that second chance last week. The Marlins surprised him with a one-day contract announced live on NBC's Today Show. Marlins manager Ozzie Guillen said he might start Greenberg, but settled for the pinch-hitting opportunity. Despite the strikeout, Greenberg returned to the dugout smiling, was greeted by high fives and hugs from his teammates for the day. "Life throws you curveballs," Greenberg said shortly before his shining moment. "Mine threw me a fastball at 92 and it hit me in the back of the head, but I got up from it and my life is great." And that's the two Jewish news of Jews around the world. We're delighted to welcome back the Two Jewish, our guest this morning, Dr. Harry Ostrer. His book is called Legacy, A Genetic History of the Jewish People. And it is an interesting, both a survey in a very accessible way, which is not always so easy, forgive me for saying this, for scientists to write. And also it gets into the science as well in a deeper way. Harry Ostrer is professor of pathology and genetics at Albert Einstein College of Medicine, director of genetic and genomic testing at Montefiore in New York. So, since we decided earlier that Jews are not so much a race, but kind of a mishpacha, a family, what are the common elements that you find scientifically?
This is really reflected in shared DNA segments, so actual strands of DNA, some of them quite large, that are shared among Jewish people, both within groups as well as across groups. But let me be a little bit more specific about this. So a Jewish diaspora group is, for instance, Ashkenazi Jews from Eastern Europe, the Sephardic Jews from the Balkans, the Mizrahi Jews from Iran and Iraq. And for instance, the degree of relatedness that one observes for any two Iranian Jews is similar to what one would observe for third cousins. For any two Ashkenazi Jews is what one would observe for fourth to fifth cousins. So that tends to qualify as mishpocha, in my opinion.
Are there any Jewish groups that you folks have tested or gotten information from who do not seem to share any of the, I don't know, deep cousinhood that seems to flourish even across regions as distinct as Iran or North Africa or Eastern Europe?
Yes, there are, but of course that doesn't make them any less Jewish. I guess to play on your title, maybe they too are too Jewish in their origins. But there are groups that were at the end of the trade line, so either in Ethiopia or further out along the Silk Road in India or China or Burma, who nonetheless are Jewish, but show less of this shared ancestry with the Jews that lived in Europe in the Mediterranean basin.
Now, we know that all Jewish children are not just, as Garrison Keillor would have it for their kids, above average, but really geniuses. There's this sort of IQ stereotype, and supposedly Ashkenazic Jews test even higher on IQ, but you explore that in some depth in your book. Can you sort of explain how that all works?
Yeah, so Over the course of time, really starting in the early 20th century, Ashkenazi Jews tended to do pretty well on IQ tests, and they tended to have IQ scores that were about 15 points higher than the population average. And that was true, for instance, in the East End of London. That was true of Jewish recruits into the army in the Second World War. It wasn't true for Jewish recruits in the First World War because a high proportion of those people didn't even speak English, so they wouldn't perform well. They didn't perform well on IQ tests. Now, IQ tests, IQ scores do change over time, so literally this is a moving target, and in each generation, the average IQ score is about 15 points higher than in the previous, and so this is referred to as the Flynn effect. It was described by the psychologist James Flynn, and it describes the phenomenon which my kids would say is obvious, which of course is that they're smarter than I am. But there is this second phenomenon that's occurred among Jews, which is that there have been a number of really quite exceptional Jews, and this has been recognized in the arts and music, but most notably in science. And about a quarter of the Nobel Prize winners in the world are Jews, although only about 2.2% of the world's population is Jewish. So, of course, the question then comes up, well, is this Jewish mothers or Jewish genes or potentially both? And I think it's going to take a bit of rigorous scientific evaluation to really sort that out.
Can I vote for Jewish fathers just a little bit?
Of course you may. And
I know we're the silent partners in this arrangement, but still.
And also, you are, of course, another stakeholder, which is Jewish rabbis.
That's
who
right.
who have been important contributors to Jewish accomplishment.
Thank you. I so appreciate that. When people look at Jewish identity, is there a DNA component of it? I mean, you conclude your book, again, it's called Legacy, A Genetic History of the Jewish People, great and very readable and enjoyable book, by exploring identity and what that means. How do genetics work with that?
So I think it does. Certainly many people are exploring this on their own now. It is possible for people to go out into the marketplace and go to direct-to-consumer genetic testing companies, have their DNA chips run, or even have their whole sequences run and do their own analyses to determine their ancestry and also to determine their relatedness to other people. So I, for instance, may want to know how I'm are related to you, and if we both agreed to have a DNA test, well, indeed we might discover that. And I go on to argue that maybe this shared mishpocha, this shared genetic legacy, is something that will further people's self-identity as being Jewish, especially at a time when certain cohesive forces, such as Holocaust remembrance, fortunately, are going by the wayside as a major cohesive force within the community.
Interesting to think about genetics as a cohesive force in Judaism. I want to thank Harry Ostreher for a great visit here on Too Jewish. His book is called Legacy, A Genetic History of the Jewish People. You can find it on Amazon and, of course, everywhere else books are sold. It's from Oxford University Press. And is there somewhere else people can go to find out more about your work?
I have a website at Albert Einstein College of Medicine. So if you Google me there, it's O-S-T-R-E-R, you can find me.
Thank you so much. And Chag Sameach, a wonderful holiday. And thank you again for a great visit.
It was my pleasure. Chag Sameach.
Chag Sameach.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest and get a final musical playout.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community.
Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday at 9 o'clock. Our guest will be the very unique motivational speaker, Alan Weingrad, a former NFL lineman on a Super Bowl winning team who became an observant Orthodox Jew. His story is remarkable. Our playout this morning comes from our house rock band, Avanim, playing klezmer for Simchat Torah tonight. My friends, may you be blessed with a Chag Sameach, a happy holiday of Simchat Torah, and may you have a Shavua Tov, a good week and a week we pray of peace.